what you hear. Peace.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston at 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston at 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. He is off this week. The March 5th, 2024 primary elections are done. Runoffs will be held on May 28th, so we can take an election breather for now. But if you need to register to vote or to update your voter information, now is a good time to take care of that. Links to county elections for Harris and adjacent counties can be found at the bottom of this week's blog post. Our first story is from CommunityImpact.com. Eyeing erosion, Brazos River projects gain state and federal funding. Design is underway on several projects in Sugar Land aimed at tackling erosion along the banks of the Brazos River. The erosion, which happens when floodwaters reach a high enough flow rate to wear away the riverbank's soil, was exacerbated by floods in 2015, 2016, and Hurricane Harvey in August 2017, Sugar Land City Engineer Jesse Lee said. This can be seen at the 150-acre Sugar Land Memorial Park, where portions of the trail near the riverbank are fenced off with a sign asking visitors not to cross due to erosion. We lost probably about 300 to 400 feet of riverbank after several flood events, Lee said. After years of funding efforts, the City of Sugar Land and Fort Bend County will receive millions from the state and federal governments to address critical erosion points along the river as part of the Brazos River Riverbank Erosion Mitigation Project, also known as Project Brazos. A 2018 study showed that if Brazos River's erosion was not addressed, parts of the banks could wash away further, causing billions in damages and potential loss of life due to the impact to infrastructure and homes. Two erosion studies identified 13 points along the Brazos River deemed the most critical for erosion already seen and the projected erosion rate, officials said. Since then, officials have sought grant funding to tackle these 13 projects, said Mark Vogler, the Fort Bend County Drainage District General Manager and Chief Engineer. Of the 13 critical sites, four locations are in the City of Sugar Land, Lee said. However, one site near the New Territory neighborhood at Highway 99 is already under construction by a levee improvement district. Now, county and city officials will partner to tackle the remaining three locations within the city limits, and city staff will also take on an erosion site near the Riverstone community. Riverstone is not included in the original 13, officials said. Additionally, Highway 59 over the Brazos River serves as an evacuation route for not only Fort Bend County, but Brazoria and Galveston counties, Lee said. The U-turn road under Highway 59 was destroyed by erosion. The Texas Department of Transportation has plans for a project to stabilize the bridge, officials said. Precinct 4 Commissioner Dexter McCoy said at the February 13th Fort Bend County Commissioner's Court meeting that it is highly unlikely that we're going to get a fully functioning turnaround back in that area, but there is work that needs to be done to stabilize the area underneath the bridge still. The story ends with Sugarland engineer Jesse Lee saying this: "It sounds like it's a lot of money to spend on riverbank erosion, but those areas protect $8 billion in public infrastructure and homes. Over 700,000 county residents are going to benefit from the project." The story then goes into some more detail about what work will be done, where it will be done, how it will be done, and which entities will be providing funding for this work. Fighting Mother Nature is an ongoing struggle for humanity, and frankly, humanity isn't making the job any easier. We should be grateful that there are still local leaders who believe that government is supposed to work for all the citizenry and not just those that vote for them, and we should be grateful that money can be found to pay for these improvements. Our next story is also from CommunityImpact.com. Montrose Management District returns, vexing some business owners. The Montrose Management District, dormant since 2018, is coming back online. Officials overseeing the district announced its relaunch in December, a move that was followed by the first board meeting in more than 5 years on December 14th. The district collects tax revenue from certain commercial properties within its boundaries with the goal of improving community safety and the local economy. It was revived after district officials received a petition from the owners of 60 properties. "We need something to fill the void of what the city of Houston hasn't been able to do. Graffiti, littering, some security issues," said Dimitri Fitakakis, a new board member and owner of the Montrose-based Greek eatery Niko Niko's. The district's past includes a courtroom battle with local property owners who are once again speaking out against its relaunch, citing concerns about how few signatures were needed to bring the district back and claiming the assessment the district previously charged was not worth the services that came in return. Now, new board members are emphasizing the need for transparency and listening to the community. District officials anticipate spending around $2.17 million on average each year for the 15 years of the service plan, which lays out district projects. District Executive Director Andrea Dewan said the district will look to improve public safety by hiring a security company to have two patrol shifts immediately, with longer-term plans involving bringing in Houston Police Department officers to work overtime in areas where it's needed most. The district will install security cameras in areas that will be informed by professional input. Other initiatives would include graffiti and litter abatement. The district could also take on maintenance of projects completed by the Montrose Tax Increment Reinvestment Zone, which is prohibited by law from funding maintenance work. Now, I admit, I have trouble understanding this whole thing with the TERS and the maintenance district, but I'm not sure how maintenance can happen without a change in state law, so maybe I'm just confused, which is entirely possible. Going on with the story, the city of Houston maintains some TERS infrastructure, but a management district could help with maintenance that goes above city standards, TERS Chair Joe Webb said. In a February 28th interview prior to a district discussion on board members, Webb said that TERS officials were open to working with the district, but were watching from a distance as board member appointments play out. The Montrose Management District first formed in 2011 when two existing improvement districts were merged. A management district is a governmental entity that can assess property taxes and fees on certain commercial property owners within its boundaries. At a February 29th special meeting, the board's three current members voted to appoint six new board members, which will later have to be approved by Houston Mayor John Whitmire. New members include Dan Fergus, the owner of Brazil, who attended the meeting to speak about his dissatisfaction with the district when it last operated. When asked by current board members if he would like to join the board as a way to represent business owner needs, he agreed. District officials said the next big steps will involve getting appointments approved by Whitmire and the Houston City Council, after which another meeting will be hosted. In a February 28th email, a spokesperson for Whitmire's office said everything is under review at this time. Andrew and I have spent a lot of time reporting on the Montrose TERS and discussing it, and I've come to think that with so much local opposition to its recreation, it should perhaps simply be dissolved. Our next story is from the TexasTribune.org. Amid white supremacist scandal, far-right billionaire power brokers see historic election gains in Texas. West Texas oil billionaires Tim Dunn and Farris Wilks entered the 2024 primary election cycle wounded. Their political network was in the middle of a scandal over its ties to white supremacists. Republicans were calling on each other to reject the billionaires' campaign money, and their enemies believed they were vulnerable, one bad election day from losing their grip on the state. Instead, Dunn and Wilkes emerged from the Tuesday primaries perhaps stronger than ever, vanquishing old political foes, positioning their allies for a November takeover of the state legislature, and leaving little doubt as to who is winning a vicious civil war to control the state party. In race after race, more moderate conservative incumbents were trounced by candidates backed by Dunn and Wilkes. Their political network made good on its vows for vengeance against House Republicans who voted to impeach their key state ally, Attorney General Ken Paxton, advancing more firebrands who campaigned against bipartisanship and backed anti-LGBTQ plus policies. Tuesday's election also paved the way for the likely passage of legislation that would allow taxpayer money to fund private religious schools, a key policy goal for a movement that seeks to infuse more Christianity into public life. All told, 11 of the 28 House candidates supported by the two billionaires won their primaries outright, and another 8 are headed to runoffs this May. And, in a sign of how much the state party has moved rightward, 5 of their candidates beat incumbents in rematches from 2022 or 2020, with some House districts swinging by double digits in their favor. Of the candidates they backed, they donated $75,000 or more to 11 of them, 6 who won and 4 who went to runoffs. Tuesday was a stark contrast from just 2 years ago, when Dunn and Wilkes' top political fundraising group poured $5.2 million into a host of long-shot candidates, much more than what they spent in the current election cycle. They lost badly that year. 18 of the 19 challengers to Texas House members they backed were defeated. Among the triumphant on Tuesday was Mitch Little, aided by at least $153,000 in Dunn and Wilkes cash, who defeated Representative Kronda Timish in a campaign that focused on Little's defense of Paxton from impeachment charges in the Senate last summer. And another Dunn and Wilkes candidate, David Covey, stunned the state by winning more votes than House Speaker Dade Phelan, the number one target of the state's far right, in part because of his role in the Paxton impeachment and refusal to ban Democrats from House leadership positions. Phelan now faces a runoff from Covey and the prospect of being the first Texas speaker since 1972 to lose his primary. I have to say, I never thought I'd see the day when Dade Phelan would be considered more moderate. Going on, certainly Tuesday's dark red wave can't be attributed solely to Dunn and Wilkes. Texas GOP primaries have historically been decided by small shares of voters, many of them further to the right of even the party's mainstream. This election cycle, the billionaire's targets also overlapped with an unlikely ally, Governor Greg Abbott, who poured more than $6 million into his quest to rid the Texas House of Republicans who defied his calls for school voucher legislation last year. Dunn and Wilkes' political group supported Abbott's opponent in his 2022 gubernatorial primary. Meanwhile, Paxton barnstormed the state as he sought retribution against incumbents who supported his impeachment. And, perhaps most importantly, former President Donald Trump was active in many contests, following the lead of Paxton and his other ally, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, and offering late endorsements that bolstered right-wing candidates. Even so, the billionaire's fingerprints appear all over the outcomes. Since January, they spent more than $3 million to support candidates through a new political action committee, Texans United for a Conservative Majority. That PAC is a rebrand of Defend Texas Liberty PAC, which has been at the center of a political maelstrom since early October. That controversy started barely 2 weeks after the state Senate acquitted Paxton in his impeachment trial, and as Defend Texas Liberty was gearing up for retribution in the primaries. Jonathan Stickland, then the president of Defend Texas Liberty, was caught hosting Nick Fuentes, a prominent anti-Semite and white supremacist, prompting Dunn to issue a rare public statement through the lieutenant governor. Stickland was quietly removed from his position with the PAC. Subsequent reporting by the Texas Tribune revealed other ties between white supremacists and groups funded by Dunn and Wilkes, prompting outcry from some Republicans and calls for the Texas GOP to distance itself from Stickland's groups. Dunn and Wilkes made their fortunes in West Texas oil, and in the last 15 years have poured more than $100 million into a constellation of political action committees, dark money groups, nonprofits, and media websites that they've used to push the state GOP further to the right. Their strategy has been to incrementally move the party toward their hardline views by painting fellow conservatives as weak and ineffectual, as rhinos or Republicans in name only, and promising well-funded primary challenges against lawmakers who defy their network and its aims. With almost endless wealth, they've poured millions of dollars into inexperienced candidates who often lose, but advance the far right's long-term goals by slowly normalizing once fringe positions, bruising incumbents, depleting their campaign coffers, and making them more vulnerable in the next election cycle. For years, many Republicans have denounced the strategy, noting that the state legislature is routinely ranked as the most conservative in the country, and warning that Dunn and Wilkes's no enemies to our right approach to politics would eventually cost the party elections and open the doors to outright extremists. This year's elections show just how successful the billionaires have been in pulling the party toward their hardline views. The article then goes on to give specific examples of candidates they have helped and why, and how those candidates did in the primaries. The story ends with this quote from House District 60 Representative Glenn Rogers, quote, "History will prove that our current state government is the most corrupt ever and is bought by a few radical dominionist billionaires seeking to destroy public education, privatize our public schools, and create a theocracy that is both un-American and un-Texan," Rogers wrote in a Wednesday op-ed in the Weatherford Democrat. He ended with, "May God save Texas." Those who are always unhappy about the Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates to unlimited anonymous political donations via super PACs, this is not relevant in Texas. Citizens United is only applicable for federal elections. States make their own political donation rules for in-state elections. In any case, what we have here is a perfect example of how lots of money in a few hands, without adequate legal constraints, can skew election results to the wishes of a few very rich individuals. We can't do anything about billionaires short of taxing them more heavily, but we can try to do something about rules governing political contributions, whether it be in cash or in kind. I think the majority of Texans know that Texas government is not only extreme, it's corrupt. Remember that Texas allows for citizen ballot initiatives. This primary season has simply made it more obvious that if the Texas legislature won't regulate political money, then Texas citizens must do so by a popular ballot initiative. So, now the question is, who'll get the ball rolling? You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, Thursdays at 6 p.m., and also Sundays at 1 p.m. We're also on Google Podcasts, which can be downloaded from both the Android or iPhone app stores. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, which is now the landing page. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type in keywords in the search bar. Shows are now at least about 80% scripted, so you can usually visually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check out our Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig, and look for me on Threads and Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. Our next story is from CommunityImpact.com. Speaking of right-wing agendas, Texas County's EPA respond to Attorney General's lawsuit on new federal climate policy. Officials from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, and Texas counties are weighing in after a lawsuit was filed by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton in efforts to block the EPA's new federal air quality standards. The new federal climate policy was announced February 7th, and aims to lower the amount of fine particulate pollution emitted by power plants, vehicles, and industrial facilities by a 2032 deadline. Paxton filed a lawsuit against President Joe Biden's administration on March 8th and said in a news release that the EPA's new air quality standards are not based on sound science and will impose significant economic harm on Texas. He said the new rule will result in the closure of manufacturing and industrial facilities and put workers out of jobs. The story goes on into more detail on the standards and governmental entities that disagree with Paxton's suit. Texas has been fighting against air quality standards for most of the 45 years I've lived in Texas. I guess that the pro-business Republican attitude has been that they only care about healthy workers until they're old enough to retire, and then the emphysema and lung cancer can take them. Remember Alan Grayson's summation of the Republican health plan. First, don't get sick. And second, if you do get sick, die quickly. That sums up Texas Republicans' attitude, I think, toward clean air. Our next story is from thewashingtonpost.com. Why National Guard troops are being deployed in New York City's subways. New York is sending hundreds of National Guard troops and state troopers into the New York City subway to address crime in one of the country's largest and busiest systems. Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul announced on Wednesday. Crime is down in the subway system compared to the heights reached during the pandemic, but Hochul's announcement comes after a string of high-profile incidents on the subway and a recent uptick in crime. In late February, a subway conductor was hospitalized after being slashed in the neck in an apparently random late-night attack at a train station in Brooklyn. Just days before, two commuters were attacked by a man wielding a hammer in a Queens subway station. And just hours after Hochul's announcement, another conductor was smashed in the head with a glass bottle in another unprovoked attack. The state's influx of law enforcement agents will add to the 1,000 city officers that Democratic New York Mayor Eric Adams placed in the subway in February after police reported a spike in crime on the city's subway platforms and trains. Hochul has also proposed legislation that would allow judges to bar people with criminal records from riding on the subway. The announcement also comes as Republicans across the country point to urban crime as a sign that criminal justice reform efforts championed by many Democrats have failed. Some New York Democrats have said concerns that fear of crime helped Republicans pick up several congressional seats across the state in the 2022 midterm elections and want to minimize that risk this year. Restoring confidence in the subway system has also been seen as critical to the city's recovery after the pandemic. There's a psychological impact. People worry that they could be next. Anxiety takes hold, the governor said. And riding the subway, which would be part of your everyday life, is filled with stress and trepidation. So what will the National Guard troops be doing? Hochul's plan calls for 750 members of the New York National Guard and 250 state troopers to be assigned to stations across the vast subway system. The task facing law enforcement is immense. With 472 subway stations, the city has more subway stations than any other system in the world. The guards and troopers will be stationed at the city's busiest stations to check bags for weapons, a show of force not often seen since the days following the September 11, 2001 attacks. Some critics said they were concerned the checks could lead to racial profiling. Said City Council member Shakar Krishnan, a progressive Democrat who represents part of Queens, quote, "I think it's ridiculous to be placing National Guard in the subway system. We need to be investing in strategies that really keep people safe, such as mental health services. Instead, what we're doing is fear-mongering that will only lead to black and brown New Yorkers being further over-policed." The elevated police presence will be temporary, according to Hochul, but she declined to give a timeline, saying she didn't want to tip off criminals. A temporary deployment is not enough, said Richard Davis, president of the union representing subway workers in a statement. This promised surge cannot just be a temporary measure. It must remain in place, Davis said. We will not be pacified. The number of serious crimes reported on the New York City subway system in January rose almost 47% compared with the same month in the year before, according to NYPD data. Police logged 233 crimes in the system, an increase that was largely driven by a spike in grand larceny, which is defined as thefts in which the perpetrator doesn't use force. In a report to the MTA's board last month, subway officials said that over the long run, quote, "we remained encouraged to see our crimes per million rider figures trend down year over year." The rate of crimes fell in February when 148 incidents were reported, a decrease of 15% compared to the same period last year, according to New York Police Department data. The stepped-up law enforcement presence is part of what Hochul is calling a five-point plan to address crime in the subway, which will include $20 million for mental health workers to work with people on the subway. She is also asking the legislature for money to add more cameras to the system. Judges would be able to ban people with criminal records from riding the subway altogether under another Hochul proposal. On social media, riders both praised the plan and posted concern. Matthew Morrison wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter, that the plan worried him, saying that he'd been stopped several times during NYPD's controversial stop and frisk program, which allowed officers to stop people they suspected of carrying a weapon. In 2013, a court ruled that the program was unconstitutional and disproportionately targeted black and Latino men. He wrote that the idea of now being subject to harassment by National Guard gives me great anxiety for basic travel again. Meanwhile, Brendan Delgado took to X to voice support for the plan. Quote, "It's important to address these high-profile crimes," he wrote. "I'm confident that the National Guard and MTA police will make a positive impact." My thoughts as an expatriate New Yorker, on some level, I can see a value to National Guard troops and state troopers as additional eyes for potential crime fighting and interventions. But the notion of inspecting people's bags when the goal is reducing random acts of violence seems a bit much. And while banning some individuals from the mass transit system may seem like a promising idea, I have no idea how that would be implemented in practice. Taking a train or a bus bears no similarity to taking an airplane or a long-haul train ticket. I respect the effort being made, but I think that deploying the National Guard in the subways is an over-the-top response, not only in terms of effectiveness, but in terms of disruption to these National Guard troopers' lives and families. But the deployment's been done, so I guess time will tell if there is any real benefit that results from it. From HoustonPublicMedia.org, gender and race among factors that led to ousting of 8 Houston-area judges in the Democratic primary. Judges Mike Engelhardt and Robert Schaefer have served on their civil court benches in Harris County since 2009, and both received high marks in the most recent judicial evaluation poll conducted by the Houston Bar Association. So did Justice Peter Kelly, who has held a place on Texas's first Court of Appeals since 2018. All three lost their Democratic primary elections on Tuesday, and by wide margins. The closest of those races involved Schaefer, who received less than 45% of the vote in his loss against Takasha Francis. "It's disappointing that the voters didn't value my experience and hard work over the past 5 years," Kelly said. South Texas College of Law professor Charles "Rocky" Rhodes said that judges' qualifications, experiences, and temperaments do not often impact the outcome of judicial races in the Houston area. Because there are 50-plus seats on the Harris County ballot, those races typically get little coverage in the news media, and many voters do not know much about incumbent judges or their opponents. Voters often make their selections based on political party affiliation, and in the case of Democratic primaries, based on a candidate's name, place on the ballot, gender, ethnicity, or even perceived ethnicity inferred from their name, according to Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor at the University of Houston. The electorate in Democrat-leaning Harris County, and particularly those who vote in Democratic primaries, clearly favors women, and in many cases, African-American women. Engelhardt, Kelly, and Schaefer, who are white men, each lost to a black woman after filing lawsuits challenging their opponent's eligibility to appear on the ballot, with Judge Erica Hughes beating Engelhardt and attorney Amber Boyd Cora beating Kelly. Justice Gordon Goodman of the First Court of Appeals also lost his Democratic primary to a black woman, Brendetta Scott. Eddie Rodriguez, the campaign manager for Denise Brown, who won her primary against an incumbent judge, said voters tend to have more trust in female judicial candidates, and he expects that to become even more of a factor in the future because of the Republican-controlled Texas legislature made abortion illegal in the state in 2022 after the landmark Roe v. Wade decision from 1972 was overturned by the United States Supreme Court. And women make up the majority of Democratic primary voters in Harris County, according to Rottinghouse. Mary Flood, an attorney, legal media consultant, and former legal journalist who works for Andrevet Legal Media, said the Democratic primary results illustrate a tragically flawed system for electing judges, whom she said have greater control over voters' lives than they might realize because they can make decisions that impact their finances and family dynamics. "There were cases in which ignorant voters just picked female names," she said, "which could result in less qualified, less capable, and even less fair judges presiding over Houston area courts." Flood said she favors the idea of overhauling how judges are selected in Texas. Many other states have judges who are initially appointed by commissions based on qualifications and merit, and then can subsequently be replaced by voters based on reviews of their performance. What happened this week has happened before in Harris County, and we've lost some of our best jurists and sometimes replaced them with mediocrity or worse, Flood said. The problem is not just the ignorant voter picking a gender or familiar name or party affiliation, it's the way we elect judges in Texas. Rodriguez and Kelly said Texas's current system of electing judges is better than the alternatives, with Rodriguez saying he puts more trust in the voting public than in state lawmakers or Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Hughes also questioned the need and desire to change the system, saying no eyebrows were raised before women and African Americans such as herself started winning judicial elections, with bench seats having historically been controlled predominantly by white men. This story, in my opinion, goes on at some length about some of the specifics of these March races and some of the other elements that may have determined the primary results. Systems for picking judges vary a lot from state to state. As mentioned in the story, some places, judges are appointed by the governor, or a commission, or, like in Texas, by voters. None of these systems is perfect, and all of them can produce poor results by some people's lights, be they voters, political partisans, or legal professionals. It's hard to make decisions about down-ballot races. There can be dozens of races that seem to demand a diligent voter's detailed attention, and that's just unrealistic. Personally, I've fallen to a system of endorsements. I have periodically looked for groups that seem to be like-minded with me and that do endorsements of down-ballot races. Because I've done some evaluation of the endorsers' positions, I've chosen to follow their recommendations unless I have a specific preference for a specific down-ballot race that might contradict my trusted sources. This system at least removes some of my personal biases and moves choices to groups I've come to trust. This makes my voting at least less random. Now, what works for you may vary, but this is what has worked for me. This is ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. You can also hear this show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org, or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick ThinkWing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Our next story is from Politico.com. Katie Porter prepared for the wrong war, an insider's guide to how Katie Porter's whiteboard wiped out. Katie Porter is ending her Senate campaign the same way she started it, by pissing off members of her own party. She enraged the Democratic establishment from the get-go, jumping into the race in January 2023, before Dianne Feinstein, the senator, had announced her plans to leave. Party loyalists were galled at the lack of deference to the elder senator, who would pass away months later. Now, Porter's insistence that she lost last Tuesday's primary because it was rigged by a deluge of special interest spending is igniting a swift backlash from Democrats who, in the era of Donald Trump's election denialism, seethed at any insinuation of a stolen election. There was nothing in this election that was rigged, said Antonia Villaraigosa, the former Los Angeles mayor and a supporter of Adam Schiff, who finished in the top two and is expected to win the seat. And virtually everyone knows that, he said. Porter rode her message of burn the system down to a distant third-place finish on Tuesday. This account of her downfall is based on interviews with eight campaign officials and outside close supporters who were granted anonymity to openly discuss the deliberations of her losing bid, as well as several other people involved in the race. The voters most energized by her scathing systemic critiques, younger, more diverse, less loyal to party labels, largely didn't show up in a primary that skewed far older, whiter, and more conservative than California's typical electorate. In the Senate race, public and private polls showed her in the game until the home stretch, when mail-in ballots started dropping in February. But by that point, she had shifted into neutral and was quickly running out of gas. Porter was done in by Schiff's three-part formula for winning. A prolific fundraiser who ran an anti-Donald Trump message and secured the early support of House Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, Schiff boosted himself and spent millions alongside allies promoting Republican Steve Garvey, while deep-pocketed corporate supporters pelted Porter with attack ads. The contours of the race boxed Porter in with few targets to lob attacks of her own. Going after Schiff, a well-liked Democrat, risked alienating voters who had no appetite for an intra-party slugfest. Attacking Garvey would only further consolidate Republican voters behind him. Fourth-place finisher Lee was, that's Barbara Lee, was eating into Porter's base, especially with liberal women in the Bay Area, but trying to peel voters away from a progressive icon and black woman would have been rife with landmines. Instead, she railed against the political system writ large, a campaign for America's most exclusive club that often felt like one long, expensive subtweet. Porter's aides and allies contend she was right to stick to her guns, even when circumstances on the ground changed considerably, but she wasn't merely a victim of those circumstances. Some inside and outside Porter's camp were overly optimistic about the chances of California Representative Barbara Lee dropping out before the filing deadline in December. Overall, Porter's campaign message never changed, perhaps to her detriment. On air and on the debate stage, Porter hammered relentlessly about out-of-touch Washington, promising to shake up the Senate. She portrayed herself as a political newcomer, even though she'd been in Congress for 5 years, to draw an implicit contrast with her fellow Democrats, who had each served more than two decades. It was the extension of a brand she had built in rapid time in the House, complete with her viral whiteboard prop she used to make CEOs squirm. She took particular gusto in calling out her own party. Her memoir, released last year, skewered Democrats for being clueless and ineffectual more than the GOP. Just before Election Day, Rolling Stone published an interview with Porter where she torched former Senator Barbara Boxer for not walking the walk on climate change. Her crusade against earmarks embodied that approach. She skewered the process as politicians securing money for pet projects, the type of backroom sausage-making that gives everyday Californians short shrift. Her stance set her apart from Schiff and Lee, both of whom said it was an essential duty of Congress members to bring home the bacon. It was classic Porter, and something her team insists resonates with voters. But in the era of Trump, it was small potatoes, particularly coming from a Democrat. Porter's team knew that Schiff had a built-in advantage by running against Trump, a crispier point of contrast than Porter's broad critique of the political system. One of the things we struggled with was we were running against corporations and special interests and folks who have an outsized effect in determining outcomes of elections, a senior campaign official said. It's just not the same sort of tangible bad guy as Trump or running against a Republican. For Schiff, as the Trump antagonist, as people see him, he always had a foil there. Not that lacing into Schiff more bluntly would have solved her problems. Democratic voters saw both Schiff and Porter favorably, and going negative against him threatened to turn her voters off. That dynamic was all the more acute for Porter as a woman. Her team saw no need to stray from their central theme. Their focus groups found that voters preferred a candidate who would challenge the political system, even more than promising to take on Trump. People were craving authenticity, her advisor said, and swerving in her messaging as her poll numbers worsened would have undermined the brand she built. Porter, who was always a gangbusters fundraiser in the House, found herself in an unusual position as the underdog when it came to money. She didn't come close to keeping pace with Schiff, who had his own lucrative small donor network after gaining cable news stardom during the first Trump impeachment. Cryptocurrency billionaire investors spent heavily on ads that portrayed Porter as a hypocrite, pointing to her own corporate contributors and her stint working for a mortgage servicing company before running for the House seat in 2018. Some on her team acknowledged one strategy that could have been pursued harder, trying to blunt Garvey's momentum by elevating another Republican, far-right perennial candidate Eric Early, in order to split the GOP vote. It would have been a tall order. Early is virtually unknown outside the most hardcore GOP activist circles and did not have the same compelling biography as an ex-baseball star. At her election night party on Tuesday, after the race was called, notably Early against her, Porter had little to say about Schiff or Garvey. Her ire was trained at the super PAC donors who spent millions to keep her out of the Senate. "You scared him, Katie," a fan yelled from the crowd. "I think we scared them," she responded, before closing with a promise that hinted she may not be fully retired from the political arena. Take my word for it, she said. I will always, always be fighting for you. On Friday, Porter reemerged with an email to her supporters praising President Joe Biden's State of the Union address as an inspiring blueprint for America where the ultra-rich don't dominate. Included were links to donate to Biden's re-election campaign. I have to admit, I've always liked Katie Porter. I thought that she was an important voice in the House when it came to calling corporate executives to account, but I also very much liked Representative Adam Schiff. For some years now, I've felt that Schiff was smart, aggressive, and would be an important voice if and when he decided to work his way up the political food chain. When the California Senate primary race shaped up as Schiff versus Porter, I just stopped giving money to either, and I was upset that now both of them would be leaving the House and at least one of them would be leaving Congress altogether. Katie Porter's post-campaign whinging is both unfortunate and disappointing. I sincerely hope she has not effectively ended her political career as a result, but time will tell. From the WashingtonPost.com, DeSantis faces pushback in Florida as voters tire of war on woke. The bill banning rainbow flags from public buildings in Florida sounded like a sure bet. State Representative David Borrero, Republican, the legislation's sponsor, argued that it was needed to prevent school children from being, quote, subliminally indoctrinated, unquote. That rationale echoed other measures championed by Governor Ron DeSantis as part of his war on woke. But instead of sailing through the Republican-dominated legislature, the DeSantis-backed bill died a quick legislative death, making it only as far as one subcommittee. It wasn't the only culture war proposal from conservative lawmakers to end in the bill graveyard during the session that ended Friday. One rejected bill would have banned the removal of Confederate monuments. Another would have required transgender people to use their sex assigned at birth on driver's licenses, something the State Department of Motor Vehicles is already mandating. A third proposed forbidding local and state government officials from using transgender people's pronouns. Some of those ideas have come up in the past and may surface again next year, but the fact that the bills failed, even with public support from DeSantis, marks a change from the days when the GOP supermajority in Tallahassee passed nearly everything the governor asked for. Florida has firmly cemented itself in recent years as ground zero for the nation's culture wars. The Sunshine State is the birthplace of conservative parental rights group Moms for Liberty, the original law restricting LGBTQ plus discussion in classrooms, one of the strictest abortion laws in the country, and legislation that has led to the banning of more books than in any other state in America, but the pushback is growing. Parents have organized and protested school book bans. Abortion rights advocates gathered enough signatures to put the issue on the ballot in Florida in November. A bill that would have established a fetal personhood stalled before it could reach a full vote. Judges are also canceling some of DeSantis's marquee laws, including the Stop Woke Act. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit ruled Monday that the law exceeds the bounds of the Constitution's First Amendment right to freedom of speech and expression. Even the governor recently admitted the state might have gone too far in trying to remove certain books from school shelves, suggesting laws on book challenges should be tweaked to prevent bad actors from having too much influence. Democrats and other DeSantis critics say the laws that the governor has pushed will continue to shape public life in Florida for years to come, and they don't expect the Republican supermajority in the State House to suddenly abandon conservative causes, but they do sense a shift. When his presidential race ended, I think that a lot of his influence and power died at the same time, said State Senator Chevron Jones, a South Florida Democrat, going on to say, I think that people in Florida and across the country, including Republicans, are starting to see that the culture wars are getting us nowhere. So, my thoughts, could this be a beginning of a sea change in Florida legislative politics? Probably not, but it may be the start of cracks in the right-wing legislative bloc. I think it's highly likely that now that DeSantis has been thoroughly humiliated as a current or future presidential possibility, he's now being treated rather like a lame duck, with Florida legislators seeing his extremist political positions being as perhaps less popular than they thought based on DeSantis's primary results. This won't be the end of Florida's right-wing agenda items in the legislature. That won't happen until Florida voters replace the extremists. But politicians periodically test the political winds, and this may be the beginning of a weather change. Time will tell. But again, elections have consequences. If people in Florida want change, they need to be registered to vote, and they need to turn out in numbers that defy the gerrymandering and voter suppression that has become Florida's election landscape. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and over 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, which is now the home landing page. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1, and you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and I am on Threads on I am on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio. See, I'll figure out which one I'm on. Our next story is from TheGuardian.com. Biden denounces Trump for $2 trillion tax cuts as he unveils his own budget plan. Joe Biden took another swipe at Donald Trump on Monday as the president revealed his $7.3 trillion budget proposal for 2025 that offers tax breaks for families, lower health care costs, a smaller federal deficit, and higher taxes on corporations and the wealthy. Biden made the remarks in an afternoon appearance in Goffstown on the outskirts of Manchester, New Hampshire. Referring to the former president as my predecessor, as he did repeatedly during last week's fiery State of the Union speech, Biden condemned Trump for making $2 trillion in tax cuts during his single term and expanding the federal deficit. I'm not anti-corporation, I'm a capitalist man, Biden said. Make all the money you want, just begin to pay your fair share in taxes, he said. A fair tax code is how we invest in things that make this country great. Unlikely to pass the House and Senate to become law, the proposal for fiscal 2025 is an election year blueprint about what the future could hold if Biden and enough of his fellow Democrats win in November. The president and his aides previewed parts of this budget going into last week's State of the Union address with plans to provide the fine print on Monday. If the Biden budget became law, deficits could be pruned by $3 trillion over a decade. Parents could get an increased child tax credit. Home buyers could get a tax credit worth $9,600. Corporate taxes would jump upward, while billionaires would be charged a minimum tax of 25%. Biden also wants Medicare to have the ability to negotiate prices on 500 prescription drugs, which could save $200 billion over 10 years. The president also called on Congress to apply his $2,000 cap on drug costs and $35 insulin to everyone, not just people who have Medicare. He is also seeking to make permanent some protections in the Affordable Care Act that are set to expire next year. All of this is a chance for Biden to try to define the race on his preferred terms, just as the all-but-certain Republican nominee Trump wants to rally voters around his agenda. Trump, for his part, would like to increase tariffs and pump out gushers of oil. He called for a second phase of tax cuts as part of his 2017 overhaul of the income tax code, which would expire after 2025. The Republican also said he would slash government regulations. He also pledged to pay down the national debt, though it is unclear how without him detailing severe spending cuts. I'll point out that he tried to do that when he first ran in 2016, too. Promising 4 years balanced budget. We're going to do things that nobody thought was possible, Trump said after he wins in last week's Super Tuesday nomination contests. Trump, Republican U.S. presidential candidate speaking in an interview on CNBC, also called for action on popular U.S. entitlement programs, including cuts, and indicated he was not likely to curb use of cryptocurrencies. His tariff plan has spurred talk of inflation, and U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said it would raise costs for American consumers. I think taxes could be cut. I think other things could happen to more than adjust that, but I'm a big believer in tariffs, Trump told CNBC, saying they help American industries when they are being taken advantage of by China and other nations. asked about Medicare, Social Security, and Medicare programs, and the nation's spending and deficits, Trump told NBC, quote, "There's a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting, and in terms of also the theft and the bad management," unquote. House Republicans on Thursday voted their own budget resolution for the next fiscal year out of committee, saying it would trim deficits by $14 trillion over 10 years. But their measure would depend on rosy economic forecasts and sharp spending cuts, reducing $8.7 trillion in Medicare and Medicaid expenditures. Biden has pledged to stop any cuts to Medicare. The House's budget blueprint reflects the values of hard-working Americans who know that in tough times, you don't spend what you don't have. Our federal government must do the same, said House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, said in a statement. First of all, I just want to reiterate what I've said many times on this show. The government is sovereign. It's not a business. It's not a household. Sovereign economics don't work the same way as a household or a business, so I'm really tired of that comparison. Now, there's a CBS News story that does add some detail to Biden's budget proposal, and I'm adding a reference link to that story and another CBS News article at the end of my blog post, which also adds details about Biden's budget proposal. According to CBS News, the budget aims to pay for tax breaks for millions of families and low-income workers, as well as senior citizens, including reviving a program that lifted millions of children out of poverty during the pandemic by raising taxes on corporations and the rich. One proposal, for instance, would completely reverse one of the cuts implemented by former President Donald Trump, whose 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act mostly eased the tax burdens on businesses and the nation's highest earners. The CBS story then goes into some more detail about how some of these tax changes and tax breaks would work. It's important to emphasize that this budget will be almost impossible to pass in the current Congress. It really should be considered more of a political campaign document to show voters what a second Biden administration could do for them if they also vote him in a Democratic-controlled Congress. And as always, and this cannot be repeated often enough, elections have consequences. As a counterpoint to the two articles I'm citing here, I'm including a link to a New York Post article that is rather more partisan and critical of the proposed Biden budget than either the Guardian story or the CBS News stories. Our next story is from the NewYorkTimes.com. Who are the gangs that have overrun Haiti's capital? And I'm going to mispronounce words and names here, so forgive me in advance. Haiti, a Caribbean nation with a long history of upheaval, is enduring one of its worst periods of chaos. Gangs have shut down the airport, looted seaports, public buildings and shops, and attacked nearly a dozen police stations. Roads are blocked, cutting off the food supply, and 4,600 inmates were freed after prisons were attacked. The Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, is stranded in Puerto Rico while gang members wreak havoc, demand his resignation, and hold up dozens of trucks filled with World Food Program food shipments. A state of emergency around Port-au-Prince, the capital, was extended another month. With the government on the verge of collapse, the United States and Caribbean nations are working to come up with a solution, or a resolution rather, including a plan for a transitional government that would restore some semblance of order in the troubled nation. As a footnote, since this particular story was written, CNN reports that Haiti's Prime Minister Henri has said he will resign after the establishment of a transitional council. Going on, experts estimate that up to 200 gangs operate in Haiti, and 20 of them in Port-au-Prince. They range from small groups of a few dozen young men who share pistols to crews of roughly 1,500 men with weekly salaries and automatic weapons who belong to the hierarchical organizations with bosses. Two main gang federations, GPEP and the G9 family, control many of the poorest neighborhoods in the capital. The criminal groups and their allies sometimes collude, but more often clash. The groups have been historically tied to political parties. G9 is affiliated with the ruling the Haitian Tete Kale Party, while GPEP tends to support opposition parties. G9 and its allies have largely taken over the ports and the roads around the country's main airport. It's been nearly impossible to drive from Port-au-Prince to northern cities because gangs have seized the north-south highway. Mr. Henri left the country last week for Kenya, where he signed an agreement paving the way for a multinational force led by the East African nation to travel to Haiti and take on the gangs. Instead, in Mr. Henri's absence, gang leaders announced a loose alliance called Vivre Ensemble, or Living Together. They launched coordinated attacks on state institutions with the goal of toppling the current government and preventing the international force from deploying. The gangs also are hoping to set up a governing council to rule the country, and they want to help pick its members so they can exert control, said Robert Muga, who researches Haiti for various UN agencies. And here the article goes into some detail about the gangs, their leadership, and their claimed objectives. Going on, why is Kenya planning to send police officers to Haiti? Kenya was one of the few countries to answer Haiti's international plea for help. Haiti has not held elections in 8 years. Its president was assassinated nearly 3 years ago. Mr. Henri, the appointed prime minister, is widely considered an illegitimate leader. The state has essentially lost credibility and power, and gangs have stepped in to fill the void. There's a lot more to this that I'll post, but right now we're running out of time for me to read it. I'll just finish by saying that Haiti has a historically problematic and violent past. Founded in 1804 as a result of the only successful slave revolt in modern history, Haiti has been governed mostly by a series of would-be emperors, dictators, autocrats, and kleptocrats. Consequently, since its founding, Haiti has been the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere and one of the poorest in the world. The current crisis of governance and the attendant violence that is resulting is just another phase in Haiti's long history of oppressive and violent governance. Over the centuries, there have been interventions by France, Spain, the U.S., and other countries, sometimes using Haiti as a pawn in their greater geopolitical ambitions and sometimes trying to quell violence and establish stable governance. But over the long term, these efforts have done nothing to improve on Haiti's instability and poverty. What we're seeing now is another unfortunate chapter in Haiti's too familiar history. I feel for the people of Haiti who are not only extremely poor, but frequently subjected to violence over which they have little or no control. I hope Kenya's intervention will help to stabilize the island and make life safer, but history suggests we not be too optimistic. If things in Haiti are to improve over the long term, it certainly has to be up to Haitians to accomplish it. We can hope. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston at 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville at 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. Andrew Ferguson has been off this week, but I do hope that you enjoyed the show and found it interesting, and I'll look forward to having you visit me again next week. Y'all take care.
Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support KPFT. Democracy Now! Airs live every weekday morning, Monday to Friday, your daily grassroots global independent investigative international news hour. If you appreciate Democracy Now! And so many other programs on KPFT, please make that call now with your support. The number to call is 713-526-5738. You can get a KPFT t-shirt. These are new, the old Lovett building, the new Caroline building. You can get a wonderful rainbow logo mug of KPFT. Just call and you can ask. You could do $8.33 a month. You could do six and change a month. Or you could do just a $25 one-shot deal or $50 or $100. It's a tax-deductible charitable contribution. 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org. Thank you so much.
It's 90.1 KPFT. Time to check in with the R&R show.
This came up, I think, a couple of thankathons ago. We decided that We were inspired by the name Breck. And Ronnie said that was his either his showbiz name or his porno name. Breck Renfro.
Yes.
You could be an action star. You could be like a movie star like Tab Hunter or, well, that thing.
Of course. But, you know, think about it. Breck. I mean, it speaks of my machismo.
Yes. It's a good name.
It speaks of my standing in the community. How was that?
I think that applies more to our pal Breck in Spring than it does to you. I think you got confused.
Enjoy the great decades of music, fun, and banter with R&B.